One Man Revolution, a guerrilla scholar warrior, a Renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
For now is truly a race of iron, and men never rest from labor and sorrow by day, and from perishing by night. And the gods shall lay sore trouble upon them. That comes from the Greek poet Hesiod, from his long work entitled Work in Days, that talks about the different ages of men, from gold, silver, bronze, age of heroes, into the age of iron. And Hesiod was writing around the end of the period that is the focus of today's podcast, the Greek Dark Age. And it was unfavorably comparing the present era in which he was writing to eras gone by, including the great Bronze Age civilizations. This is Prof. CJ. Welcome to the Dangerous History Podcast, and the focus today is going to be on the Greek Dark Ages, or Dark Age. I mostly say Dark Age, but I'm warning you ahead of time, I might use them interchangeably. Sorry. The Greek Dark Age lasted from approximately 1100 BC to 800 BC, depending on exactly who you ask and how you date it and bookend it. So, the Greek Dark Age followed directly on the heels of that Bronze Age collapse that I talked about in the last two episodes, and if you haven't already, you might want to check those out. Episodes, I believe, 27 and 28. This time, I'm going to zoom in just on Greece and examine how the collapse affected this region. It's very interesting because Greece was probably the hardest hit area during the collapse in many ways, yet it did ultimately bounce back to produce the so-called Classical Age that far surpassed the Bronze Age Greek civilizations in most cultural and intellectual achievements. Now, up front, I should point out that some scholars debate the degree to which there really was a Dark Age in Greece around this time, and to me, some of this takes on the form of scholarly nitpicking and basically like trying to make a name for yourself by challenging something that everybody's long taken for granted. And while I think that's valuable, and I'm all in favor of historians and archaeologists and whatever offering revisions based on the evidence, here I'm not so sure that there's enough evidence that there was no Dark Age. I mean, the changes and the physical evidence for those changes are just too dramatic. To me, it certainly is debatable exactly how dark the Dark Age was in Greece, and it's also debatable exactly how long it lasted and how bad it was. But based on everything that I've seen anyway, the archaeological record is pretty darn clear that during this era in Greece, there was a sustained retrogression in such things as wealth, sophistication, standard of living, learning, skills, on and on and on and on. And the physical evidence is so overwhelming that to me it's ridiculous to argue that there flat out was no Dark Age or anything resembling a Dark Age in this period in Greek history. So first thing I want to do is set the stage by taking a brief look at Bronze Age civilization in Greece, which was primarily dominated by what today we call the Mycenaeans. This is not what they would have called themselves, by the way. This is what we call them based on one of the most important archaeological sites that is used to learn about this civilization. Now, I did mention Bronze Age Mycenaean civilization a little bit in my two episodes on the Bronze Age collapse, but we'll do a little more explanation of them here in order to set the stage for the collapse and to contrast it with the changes that come afterward. Now, there was an earlier civilization that was around even before the Mycenaeans in roughly what we think of as Greece, the Aegean region, and this was the so-called Minoan civilization, again, what we call them today, centered primarily around the island of Crete and some of the other Aegean islands. And it seems that the Mycenaeans, by the way, took these people over in some fashion around the 1300s BC. They still existed as a distinct culture, noticeably different from the Mycenaeans in a lot of ways, but kind of under their domination. Now, the Minoans were the first Bronze Age civilization known to exist in the region that we think of as Greece, although scholars point out that, in a way, they're technically not Greek themselves because they did not use a version of the Greek language, which the Mycenaeans, however, apparently did use the Greek language, or something, you know, a clear predecessor to it. The Minoan's written language, which we call today Linear A, is actually untranslatable to us. We don't have the magic key, the Rosetta Stone, or whatever it would take to understand this particular script. The Minoans seem to have been the earliest people in the region to have developed what today is known as Mediterranean polyculture, which is simultaneously cultivating multiple crops that sort of complement each other in terms of how they grow and what seasons they require the most intensive labor, and so on and so on. And the three most important crops of Mediterranean polyculture are grapes, which are primarily used to turn into wine, olives, which are primarily turned into oil, you know, from which the oil is extracted, and then grains. And this has really been the centerpiece of agriculture in Greece and even in a lot of other parts of the Mediterranean world ever since. Now, Mycenaean civilization reached its height in wealth and power from about 1600 to 1200 BC. What we know of the Mycenaeans indicates that they seem to have gotten a lot of their culture from the Minoans and then maybe adapted it, changed it a little bit for their own purposes. So, for example, Mycenaean art is, in many ways, clearly inspired by or derived from art that you find in Crete from the Minoans. And Mycenaean writing, which modern scholars call Linear B, is also clearly connected to the Minoans' Linear A. Now, Mycenaean culture seems to have really celebrated martial values, which doesn't seem to be true of the Minoans. And the way that archaeologists try and figure this out is they look at, you know, what are people building monuments to? What are people depicting in their art? What are people burying their dead with? What do they seem to really prize in terms of material possessions? And it seems like the Minoans may not have been a very militaristic culture. They may have been able to rely more on their navy for defense, but the Mycenaeans placed a lot of emphasis on martial values. The ruling classes were generally like a warrior aristocracy. And in this Bronze Age era, remember, the super weapons of the day were chariots. And chariots were very expensive, required a lot of specialized skill, so the only people who owned and used chariots tended to be elites. So this is the type of society the Mycenaeans had. Think of the charioteers almost as being like the elite aristocratic knights of their day. Now, though they clearly placed a lot of celebration on the martial values, it's true they also engaged in high volumes of trade. The Mycenaeans demonstrated cultural unity, but political fragmentation. They were separated into a multitude of small jurisdictions. And if you read something like Homer's Iliad, you get a sense of this when he talks about all the different little kings of Greece. Greece has, for much of its history, tended towards political fragmentation, and a lot of it has to do with geography. The rugged landscape makes it harder in ancient times to try and rule it from one centralized authority. The characteristic pattern of settlement one finds in Mycenaean ruins would be a fortified hilltop citadel that was also the palace, surrounded by farmlands which were controlled by the palace. So that means that Mycenaean jurisdictions were similar to a city-state in size, although unlike the later Greek city-state institution known as the polis, which we'll get to a little bit towards the end, these polities were purely top-down monarchies. Now, all the evidence is this is a pretty wealthy society when you look at their material remains. They had a lot of luxury goods, a lot of exotic goods, a lot of very well-made, finely crafted goods. So it was a wealthy society, at least for those at the top, maybe not so much for those at the bottom. Mycenaean kingdoms had command economies, centrally controlled, in which the monarch, through the means of a complex bureaucracy, ran a command economy. And they micromanaged things to a surprising degree, especially given the communications technologies they would have had at the time. But remember, they're working with fairly compact territories. They even would have micromanaged things such as when the farmers would plant and harvest their crops and how they were to fertilize. All these sorts of things were centrally directed. Little to no initiative left to the individual farmer. Religion was also under the control of the monarch and his bureaucrats. So Mycenaean kingdoms, in a lot of ways, really resembled miniature versions of an Egyptian pharaoh's government. Just, you know, operating on a smaller scale, but the same sort of idea. tombs of the royal Mycenaeans contain lots of jewels and gold, including even such fancy things as solid gold death masks. And I put a picture of one as the little picture for the post that'll go along with this episode on prophecyday.org. Archaeological evidence reveals that this civilization was very heavily plugged into the Bronze Age Mediterranean trading networks. A surprising amount of goods from places as far away as Egypt and even Mesopotamia have been found in Mycenaean cities. And much of the durable goods that they have seem to have been imported, particularly when you're speaking of, you know, finely crafted items made out of precious metals. One of their number one exports, as far as we can tell from the record, was aromatic oils. They would exchange with these far-flung places for their goods. Now, Mycenaean kingdoms are often described as pyramid-style social structures, again, with the king at the top, and then his noble warriors and his bureaucrats just below him, filtering all the way down to the common peasants and slaves who are performing the menial tasks and working the land and so on. And somewhere, starting around 1100 and over the space of a relatively short amount of time, this wealthy, sophisticated civilization that had been around for hundreds and hundreds of years and had survived all kinds of problems before really fell apart, collapsed, faced catastrophe, whatever you want to call it. Now, as to the possible causes of the collapse, I'm not going to get into it too heavily in this episode, because I already delved into it a bit more in the previous episodes covering the Eastern Mediterranean Bronze Age collapse as a whole. Theories include such things as droughts and other climate problems or climate changes, outside invasions. In the case of Greece, scholars used to believe in the so-called Dorian invasion, largely because it's mentioned in a lot of ancient Greek sources that are written in the Archaic and Classical period. But modern scholars generally don't give this much credence. The idea was that there were these sort of Greekish barbarians who lived north of the actual Greek land mainland, and they came in and invaded, and they messed things up, and because they were really good at war, they were able to conquer the Mycenaeans, but they were not nearly as what you might call refined, culturally sophisticated, and so on, and so that this plunged Greece into the Dark Ages. The problem is the hard evidence for this is just not really impressive, and it seems to have been a semi-mythological invasion. Now, that said, it does not at all mean that there was not some sort of outside invasion or invasions. For example, the sea people might have, you know, genuinely come in and ravaged the place. And remember, if you've listened to the last episode, the Sea Peoples, they're these sort of tribes who move around by land and sea through the Mediterranean during this time period, causing all sorts of problems and breaking stuff and so on. The evidence seems to show that in the period just leading up to when the collapse happened, a lot of Mycenaeans fortifying their defenses were thinking and acting rather paranoid, as if they were worried about outside attack. So there probably was some degree of outside invasion going on. It's just the exact narrative of the Dorian invasion and all that may not have really been what happened. Theories also sometimes include internal uprisings, and though this might have happened on occasion, the evidence that this is was a major, huge, widespread thing that caused the collapse is pretty darn shaky, as far as I know. And occasionally other factors are trotted out as possibly causing or contributing to the collapse, you know, natural disasters, diseases, all sorts of things. Now, as mentioned previously in, I guess, the last episode, I'm a supporter of what's generally called systems collapse, although I prefer to call it by the much more irreverent, non-academic name, the clusterfuck perfect storm model of civilizational collapse. And this idea combines the notion that there's multiple problems overlapping and feeding into each other in sort of a cascading or domino effect, combined with a situation where your existing institutions are stagnant, are too top-heavy, are too complex for their own good, and are unable to adapt to all these problems and changes. So these very top-down, centrally controlled Mycenaean kingdoms, not real good at adapting to serious problems and changes all happening seemingly at once. What I really want to focus more on is the collapse itself and its effects and what we can tell from the physical record. Because regardless of what the exact mixture, the exact stew, the exact proportions of causes that led into the collapse, and I'm sure it was a mixture of probably at least around a half dozen problems, the physical evidence indicates that Mycenaean Bronze Age culture almost totally disappeared within a few generations, say from about 1200 to 1100 BC at most, and it may have even occurred over a shorter period than a century. May have been as little as about 50 years that Mycenaean civilization collapsed and fell into darkness. Because there is no known Greek writing from the actual Dark Age itself, the only hard evidence we have is physical archaeological evidence. So the experts on this are almost always archaeologists, and they basically have to act like forensic detectives. They have to look at the evidence, at the remains, and then try and figure out what conclusions they can draw from that. And it's very interesting. I mean, and these people, when you read the sorts of books that cover this, they'll have chapters full of nothing but looking at different pottery designs over the years and then figuring out, you know, what this tells us about cultural interactions and levels of sophistication and what have you. And I'll be blatantly honest, when reading a lot of this archaeological work, personally, I find it dry as hell. But it's also obviously very important, very useful. So I'll tip my hat and say, you know, God bless these archaeologists who can sit there and study pottery all day long and write, you know, hundreds of pages on different pottery designs and things, because someone's got to do it. I mean, to me, I look at it the same way as someone who does a very difficult, monotonous, tough sort of a job. You know, I'm glad it's not my job, but I'm glad somebody's doing it. Now, the physical archaeological evidence is supplemented with accounts that were written a little bit later, such as, for example, the works of Hesiod and the works of Homer, although these were written really during the period when Greece was coming out of the Dark Ages, not in the midst of the Dark Ages. And in addition, because these sorts of sources are generally based on orally transmitted stories, they're kind of semi-mythological, and you can't take them as definitive fact. It doesn't mean everything in them is untrue. A lot of it may actually be at least based on true things, but you've got to take it with a grain of salt. There are plenty of things in sources like Homer and Hesiod and others that have been just flat-out disproven by the physical evidence. On the nature of this evidence, Carol Thomas and Craig Conant, authors of a very good, relatively recent book on the phenomenon of the Greek Dark Age and recovery entitled Citadel to City-State, say, quote, "The Greek Dark Age deserves its name in large measure because of the limited evidence it furnishes to modern-day students. By comparison with the preceding Bronze Age, the physical remains are simpler as well as fewer. Palace centers fell into ruins and were not rebuilt. With them disappeared both the administrative records and the road systems that had linked parts of a territory with one another. Large works projects of every sort are no longer in evidence, and great stores of wealth are not to be found." End quote. So I just want to go through, point by point, the major things we can see that show A, there was a Dark Age, and B, it was pretty rough for those who lived through it. First is physical destruction of buildings and infrastructure. Lots of evidence of this. Roads, palaces, defensive structures such as walls, and almost any other type of significant infrastructure of the time period you can think of was degraded or was destroyed outright. Now, sometimes it seems that the destruction may have been caused by natural disaster, but the key thing that shows you there were other problems going on is that these things were not repaired or rebuilt. This part of the world has earthquakes and things like that on a pretty regular basis. Generally, what happens is if a city sustains damage from an earthquake, in fairly short order, people are fixing it and rebuilding things that are totally broken and whatever. And the fact that this was not done during the Dark Age shows you how depressed the economy and the society must have been. Sometimes, though, there's clear evidence that this destruction may have most likely been caused by human attack. Outside invaders, by the way, are more likely to be successful here than uprisings from within. Now, here's why. During the Mycenaean period, late Bronze Age in Greece, you've got a very top-down society. Only the elites would have had really good weapons and the training to use them. The commoners, the slaves, the peasants, and so on wouldn't have had this and would have had a very, very hard time standing up successfully to a bunch of full-time professionals with the best armor and weapons of the time. But outside invaders might be, you know, experienced, well-armed fighters themselves and might have had a chance. Evidence of fire is usually considered evidence of likely human attack. Common practice to burn a city after you've sort of taken it and sacked it. Some scholars have argued that the fires might be the result of earthquakes, but the problem with this is that's a modern idea. We're used to, in modern times, earthquakes frequently causing fire, because in modern cities, there's gas lines and all sorts of, you know, electrical infrastructure and things that when they get clobbered by an earthquake, very frequently fires break out. But in an ancient town, there really was much less that could possibly ignite as the result of an earthquake. So in general, when you find smashed up remains of a city that also shows indications of massive fires, that's probably more likely to have been, you know, barbarians took the town and burned it after they carried off what they wanted. Sometimes infrastructure was falling apart simply through natural crumbling and degrading over time due to the fact that no one was apparently willing or able to perform basic maintenance and repairs. And there's evidence that many, many, though by no means all, Mycenaean cities were actually flat out abandoned during the Dark Age. Next major effect of the Dark Age in Greece, population decline. Experts on the Greek Dark Age often estimate that the population of the region may have decreased by as much as 90% from what it had been at the height of the Bronze Age. Now, most of this, no doubt, was due to people dying of malnutrition, disease, barbarians coming in and killing people, whatever. And also, you can imagine there was most likely a lowered birth rate in these troubled, unstable times, and then also you would have had increased child mortality if there's things like food shortages and epidemic diseases and barbarians clobbering you and stuff like that. But some of the population decline in Greece was also due to people fleeing. People just getting the hell out, bugging out, as modern survivalists might put it, right? Getting the hell out of Dodge when the shit is hitting the fan. And there's a fair amount of evidence of this, that there were Greeks moving to other parts of the Mediterranean world. In general, those who fled the Greek mainland were more likely to be more elite people, even including sometimes the royalty, because it was the elites who had more resources, more means to get the heck out, you know, more access to ships and more ability to take some wealth and exit, right? So this is interesting. This is very modern in a way. And there's evidence, archaeological evidence, found on such places as the island of Cyprus that indicates the presence during the Greek Dark Age of Mycenaean elites moving in there, you know, basically as coming as refugees or whatever you want to call it. And these Mycenaean elites were not present there before. So they saw the way things were going and got out. Now, the elites were hit pretty hard, the Mycenaean elites, because many of them fled. Those who did not flee were often the first to get targeted in the case of outside invasion. This was an elite warrior society. That means those at the top of the social pyramid actually are the ones, you know, kind of refreshing difference from modern times. They're the ones that'll actually go out there and fight. So they might have been the hardest hit from invasion as well as immigration. Another aspect of the Dark Age in Greece in terms of its effects is isolation. When things declined, when the shit started to hit the fan, the Mycenaeans became cut off from the wealthier and in many ways more advanced civilizations to the east and south of them. And of course, at the same time, a lot of those civilizations were having serious problems of their own, too. Under these circumstances, it became harder for Greeks to travel even locally, even around to different parts of Greece. So localism becomes the way of life for most people during the Dark Ages, just like in the case of the European Dark Ages after the fall of Rome. Foreign goods, which had frequently been found amongst Greek Bronze Age artifacts, become extremely rare during the Dark Age. And authors Thomas and Conan, again, of Citadel to City-State, write, quote, "While Bronze Age society was based on centers of power that were in contact with one another and with other parts of the Aegean and Mediterranean in ways that generated impressive wealth, the refugee communities, particularly characteristic of the early Dark Age, existed in relative isolation," end quote. And this has an effect not just on cultural activity, but on material standard of living and basic access to goods. Because during the heyday of the Bronze Age in the Eastern Mediterranean, it was almost a miniature version of globalization, where different areas traded with places all over the Eastern Mediterranean world, and each would, kind of through specialization and comparative advantage, do what it was the best at, and then trade that with somebody else for what they were the best at. Well, once this breaks apart, that means everybody's got less access to less variety of goods and of lower quality than they had before. Author V.R. Desborough, who wrote a book entitled The Greek Dark Ages, often considered a classic of this topic, writes of what the communities of the Dark Age in Greece were like, quote, "One gets the impression of small communities, by no means isolated from each other, but making no attempt to combine for mutual protection, with few stonemasons or craftsmen left, and in any case with insufficient manpower either to fortify their settlements or to resist any intrusion. For the most part, they were tiny little groups distributed over the landscape, living in the ruins of the former great towns, in the shadow of the departed greatness. Each community, no doubt, had its chief, a sort of petty king, but in most cases the earlier ruling families had been slain or had fled. In general, there must have been a tendency towards greater isolation of community from community." In other words, you know, cutting off community from the community down the road. "With an extremely small population, large tracts of cultivated land will have become overgrown, and the roads will soon have fallen into disrepair," end quote. And in that quote is already hinted at the next major effect of the Dark Age on Greece, which is the loss of technology and crafts, skills, in making things. Again, V.R. Desborough, zooming in on this particular phenomenon, says, quote, "The craftsmen and artists seem to vanish almost without a trace. There is very little new stone construction of any sort, far less any massive edifices. The metalworker's technique reverts to the primitive, and the potter, except in the early stages, loses his purpose and inspiration," end quote. And writing specifically about the early Dark Age, which was in many ways the darkest part, Desborough writes, quote, "My impression is that there was simply no attempt to achieve anything worthwhile. The pottery was spiritless. Neither the potter nor his customer seems to have cared much about what was made, an extremely rare event in Greek lands. The bronze work was, so far as one can tell, quite competent, but there are no refinements. Precious metals were almost unknown. And finally, there is no evidence that they had any ability to build in stone. For once, the craftsman's skill and artistic imagination of the Greeks seems to have been dormant, and I would suppose that there was no incentive. Whether the reason for this lay in the exhaustion after some harrowing experience, or in the continual necessity to wrest a bare living from the land, I do not know," end quote. Another major negative impact of the Dark Age on Greece was the loss of literacy. And Thomas and Conant, again in Citadel to City-State, say that the Dark Age centuries in Greece, quote, "were apparently a time of non-literacy, at least from our perspective. While it is possible that some Dark Age Greeks could read or write, no evidence survives for the benefit of the historian," end quote. In other words, there's literally been no physical evidence whatsoever that Greece had any literacy in it from sometime around 1100 BC until sometime in the 700s BC. So literally 3 centuries plus, there's no evidence of any type of writing whatsoever. And the notion that there might have actually been a fair amount of literacy in Dark Age Greece and somehow magically no evidence survives of it is problematic, because there's physical evidence of literacy, as far as I know, in pretty much every ancient civilization that has ever been, you know, explored by archaeologists. There's always something, you know, you always eventually will find a tablet or some item that has a little bit of writing on it, or whatever. Even if you can't decipher it, you can at least tell, you know, this is some type of writing. And there's nothing like that for the Greek Dark Ages. So yeah, I guess it's theoretically possible that maybe like 1/100th of 1% of the population somehow managed to remember how to read and write, but there's just no evidence to show that should be taken as granted, that that's true. It's just possible, however unlikely. Imagine that, a society that was pretty sophisticated and complex and had writing and had... And think about the Mycenaean kingdoms would have had to have had the ability to keep elaborate records with their centrally planned economies. And then literacy essentially disappears and remains gone for hundreds of years. Just incredible to think about. Greece's collective memory was, for about 3 centuries, comprised, as far as we can tell, entirely of oral tradition. And while it's true that these can sometimes prove reasonably effective at preserving certain stories and histories, the reality is they're just not as reliable as written sources. They change over the years as they're told and retold and embellished. And you have to remember that the professional storytellers who would have learned these stories and told them to people around fires or whatever, they're more than historians, they're entertainers. And so you have to assume that in the course of telling and retelling their stories, they get a feel for what the audience likes, they embellish those parts, they skip over stuff the audience wouldn't like, and in the process, while they might create something that has somewhat more literary value, they might be losing a lot of the facts that may have, you know, been there in the first place, if they were there. So again, sources such as probably the most famous being Homer contain a mixture of fact and myth or legend or whatever you want to call it. And Homer's stories were written down basically right as writing was starting to really come back into Greece. So it reflects what would have probably been many generations of oral storytelling being passed down, and then finally when writing comes along, somebody writes them down. One more major effect of the Dark Age on Greece would be a decrease in land cultivation, which makes perfect sense. All evidence is that the amount of acreage that was being cultivated in the Mycenaean Age dropped off at least proportionately to the population decline, so that many acres that were previously farmed were reclaimed by nature for centuries. I once heard a lecture from historian Robert Kagan. If I remember correctly, he's at Harvard. He's one of America's top experts on ancient Greek history. And he was giving a lecture about the Dark Ages in Greece and talking about what it must have been like if you were a regular person living through this in Greece. And he said, and I'm quoting here, about what it would have been like to live through this, quote, "They have no choice. They cannot rely, as human beings typically do, on just doing what your parents did, just inheriting a tradition that functions, that works, that keeps you going. They couldn't do that. The survivors had to figure out a new way to do things, and they didn't do anything new in a hurry. This all came hard, and at the cost, I'm sure, of a lot of human life and a lot of misery. But what comes out of it is something different," end quote. And V.R. Despero writes of this, quote, "The greatest effect of all, however, must have been a psychological one. They had seen their whole way of life destroyed or seriously endangered, and at least the generation that witnessed the catastrophe must have lived under the shadow of a constant fear," end quote. And I think that's a very important and insightful point, that aside from all the physical degradation, imagine the effect it had on people's psychology. Imagine what it would be like if you happened to be living during the generation in which the Dark Age set in which the collapse happened, and then, you know, the shit hit the fan, and the end of the world as we know it, Teotihuacan, happened, right? Wow. You know, to have maybe grown up in what was still a prosperous Bronze Age civilization, and then witnessed a series of problems and disasters, witnessed the kingdoms that you had grown up under the control of fall apart, witness depopulation start, there's just not as many people around as there used to be, witness farms going feral, for lack of a better term. It must have just been an incredible thing. Terrible, too, I'm sure. Frightening. Barbarians possibly coming in and breaking stuff in your neighborhood. Just imagine what it must have been like to have been an average person living through this. Now, for those who were born after the Dark Age had already been rolling for a few generations, they would have known nothing different, so it probably wouldn't have hurt their feelings very much that they lived in this Dark Age, you know, messed up society. That was just normal to them. But it must have been hard on that first generation or two that could still personally, firsthand, remember some of the Bronze Age. So it was pretty bad. Not a great time, I'm sure, for most people. I'm sure life expectancy was down and all that sort of stuff. However, in the long run, in the grand scheme, crisis can create opportunities. For some, anyway. Obviously, if you're someone who starves or who gets killed by a barbarian or whatever, no opportunity for you from this catastrophe. But if you are one of the ones who made it through, you might have some opportunities that you would never have had Bronze Age Mycenaean society endured. Because remember, you had essentially a decapitation of Mycenaean society due to death and immigration of the ruling classes. And yes, in the short term, this creates a lot of chaos and instability. But it also, over time, allowed some individuals to have a lot more opportunities for advancement in the long run than they would have had if the Mycenaean governments had endured. For those with the right skills in the right place at the right time, this crisis might have actually done them some favors. And it's not just a matter of luck, I'm sure. It is right skills, right place, right time. Those are all more or less luck elements. But we also must imagine that it must have took wise decision-making on the part of those who ended up benefiting in one way or another from the collapse to seize these opportunities when they came along, to not just, you know, be completely beaten down by the downfall of society around you, but to somehow keep trying to somehow better your situation. Now, chief among those who ultimately in the long run benefited from the collapse were small farmers, but also artisans. People like this would now be freed up from centralized control in most situations. Here's the reality. Collapse leads to decentralization. And though in the short run, this is disruptive and damaging and can have many negative side effects, in the long run, what usually ends up happening, assuming nothing else comes in to clusterfuck you even worse, assuming you get some breathing space from outside invasions and disasters and whatever, in the long run, decentralization generally tends to lead to greater prosperity and a more vibrant culture than ever before once the society starts to recover. After emerging from the Dark Age, in most instances, the Greek small farmer, artisan, and merchant would have been independent from centralized bureaucratic control, which was generally how he had to operate in the Mycenaean Age, under some sort of centralized control, someone else telling him what to do a lot. And what happens is, when Greece comes out of the Dark Age, an economy emerged that bore more resemblance to what we think of today as a market economy. Now, there were some notable exceptions. For example, archaic and classical era Sparta really didn't have a market economy at all, but a lot of the Greek city-states did. All this information we have on the Dark Ages is all kind of big picture and collective sorts of statements, and the reason is we've got almost no information on any particular individual. So all we can look at is these big collective patterns of how people's lifestyles changing, how's their material culture changing, and so on. So understand that that's why my overview of the effects of the Bronze Age might have seemed kind of generic and broad. But that's about all we can do is look at the archaeological evidence and make statements like that based on the evidence. The Greeks gradually recovered from the Dark Age, but recovery was clearly well underway by the 8th century BC. roughly around 800 BC, give or take, the Greeks relearned writing. This time, apparently, from the Phoenicians, and it was a true alphabet. It was very different from the old linear scripts of the past. This new alphabet that the Greeks developed was based on, basically, they took the Phoenician alphabet and then improved on it by, among other things, adding vowels. This new writing system was unrelated, as far as we can tell, to the earlier Minoan and Mycenaean scripts, and this is why we can't translate those early scripts. Greece also began relearning many crafts from about 800 BC onward, including metallurgy. Only now, iron replaced bronze as the metal of choice for most applications. This is the Iron Age. Remember that line from Hesiod. For now, truly is a race of iron. Iron was cheaper to make, and for many applications it was superior to bronze. For example, in weapons, iron is able to hold its edge better than bronze. Bronze continued to be used for some applications, such as armor. It was preferred to iron for armor. But not only were iron weapons generally superior and cheaper, but iron tools and implements also worked better than bronze for many applications. And this led to increased agricultural productivity because farmers were able to access better and cheaper farm implements and tools, and thus were able to increase their crop yields. There was the first Olympics, or Pan-Hellenic Games. This is traditionally dated to 776 BC, although it's doubtful how accurate that date is. But whether it is or not, it was roughly around that era, and this is often seen as an indicator of Greek recovery. That the various parts of Greece are doing well enough and having enough contact with each other that they're able to organize something as sophisticated as the Pan-Hellenic Olympic Games. Some scholars have argued that basically what had happened was Mycenaean civilization had been stagnating because of its top-heavy centralization and bureaucratization of society, and so that that made a collapse in Dark Age in a way necessary to end that civilization and pave the way for something new. Again, a common analogy would be something like a forest fire occasionally being necessary in nature to clear out the old growth and make way for new things. Other scholars argue that there's actually a lot more continuity between Bronze Age and classical Greek culture, so Mycenaean culture in this argument didn't die out as much as it sort of dimmed for a while, and then with some outside influence mixed in, morphed into classical Greek culture. This period, as Greece came out of the Dark Age, is called the Archaic Age. It's usually defined as starting somewhere between about 800 and 750 BC, and it's usually dated as running through about 500 to 480 BC. So, essentially, it's from the time Greece starts to emerge from the darkness, learn writing, and so on, to around the time of the beginning of the Greek Wars with Persia. And then the Greek Wars with Persia usually start the so-called classical period. Now, in this archaic age, as they emerged from the darkness, Greece began to renew contacts with the outside world, and from the outside world began relearning skills and knowledge and techniques and crafts that had been lost. And to paraphrase, I think it was Socrates, the Greeks invented very little, but they generally improved upon the invention of other cultures. For example, the Phoenician alphabet I mentioned before, which the Greeks adopted and then improved upon. There's also evidence from pottery that the Greeks were getting back in contact with far-flung places of the outside world, including as far away as Mesopotamia. You can see a clear Mesopotamian influence working its way into a lot of Greek art and artifacts. Now, some key developments in society occur along with and probably contribute to this emergence from the darkness. One is the rise of the polis as the political organization of Greece. The polis is a city-state that governs a city and sort of the immediate surrounding agricultural hinterlands. And in that way, it sounds similar to a small Mycenaean kingdom, but it's very different in terms of how it's organized and how it's run. Though it's not always truly democratic, overall the polis is a much more bottom-up rather than top-down organization, usually with at least some degree of participation in governing for its citizens. Although, to be clear, citizens would be defined differently, you know, who is a citizen, differently in each different polis, and pretty much across the board, citizenship was defined much more narrowly than we do today. Today, usually, most of the adults living in a country are citizens of that country. In a Greek polis, it would be a smaller percentage than that who actually were considered full citizens. Even in Athens, most of the people who actually lived in Athens during its heyday of democracy were not actually citizens legally. Whereas Mycenaean settlements were centered around the royal palace and its citadel, the polis, though they usually had some sort of a hilltop, citadel, or temple-type structure, the real center of life in the polis tended to be the agora, which was an open area usually doubled as a market and as a meeting place for citizens for political activities. And whereas the citadel showed and reflected the centralization of power in Mycenaean kingdoms, both political and economic, the agora showed the decentralization of political and economic power that existed in archaic and classical Greece. Along with the emergence of the polis as a political organization, you got the rise of the hoplite militia system, in which essentially Greek middle-class people, because you had to be wealthy enough to afford good armor and weapons, Greek middle-class people formed the backbone of their polis's army. And these were independent people of reasonable means who owned their own weapons. They were citizen soldiers, not full-time professionals. And they had an idea that participation in your polis's military went hand in hand with your participation in its politics. So again, extremely different from the Mycenaean era, where armies were dominated by elite aristocratic warriors fighting on chariots. These hoplites were foot soldiers. They were infantrymen, fought on foot with heavy armor, heavy shield and helmet, and then also long spears. And they fought as a phalanx. They fought as a group, packed tightly together. Again, a much more kind of middle-class dominated military. And in many ways, the development of the independent, privately owned family farm was the key evolution of both the polis and the hoplite militia system. In other words, it's what really made this type of political and military organization even possible. And the historian Victor Davis Hansen, an expert on ancient Greece and also a farmer himself, has extensively documented this development and its importance in both Greek and larger Western history. And his book, The Other Greeks, is the one that's the most focused on this, although a lot of his other books on ancient Greece mention this phenomenon as well. The development of the notion of private family ownership of farms, rather than having all the land essentially owned by the king or something, is a huge revolution. The sense of family ownership incentivized farmers to take the initiative, to invest heavily in improving their lands and improving their yields in all sorts of innovative ways that Greeks had never done before. Back when the Mycenaean palaces just controlled everything, there wasn't really much in the way of private property for anyone other than arguably those at the very top. And so if you were a farmer in the Mycenaean period, you would just sort of do whatever your bosses told you to do, but you wouldn't really take any initiative to try and improve the land and come up with new ideas on your own because you didn't really own the land, you didn't have the right to its produce. The Mycenaean economies were primarily redistributive. The kings would just collect all the produce from their area and then would divvy it up as they saw fit. So why the hell would you work extra hard and try to innovate if you're a farmer under those circumstances? But man, if you actually own your own farm and you're going to be passing it down to your next generation of your family, now you've suddenly got all sorts of incentives to really try and do a good job and be innovative. And a lot of the crops they started planting were more and more perennials. Because the idea is, hey, these vines or trees or whatever are going to still be around for my grandkids and great-grandkids, so I'll plant those in addition to just annual crops. Think of these sorts of people as basically middle-class small farmers. The average farm size would have probably been around 10 acres, and given the geography of Greece, its rugged terrain, and so on, most farms would have at least some of the land not be ideal for growing all the crops. So what Greek farmers developed was a very efficient and intensive style of farming that incorporated multiple crops on the same farm in complementary ways, and basically tried to get the most out of their small and not always the greatest pieces of land. This agrarian independence and self-sufficiency was really the economic base of the Greek version of liberty and citizenship that evolved in many of the poleis, which is, by the way, plural for polis, is poleis, and which provided the context in which classical Greek civilization, still admired as a Golden Age benchmark by many today, would ultimately emerge. So that's my overview of the Greek Dark Age and the recovery from it. I'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments about this particular show, please feel free to leave them in the comment section for this episode at profcj.org. Also, any questions or comments, you can email me at the address profcj@profcj.org. If you have any ideas for future shows you might like me to do, any topics you'd like me to cover any time in history, I'd be interested to hear from you. I can't guarantee I'll do it. I have to simultaneously agree that it's a good idea for the show and that it's something that I have the ability to do. In some cases, if you suggest a topic and I'm already knowledgeable about it, it's possible I might be able to slap it together pretty quick. If it's something that I agree is a cool idea for the show, would be good to do something on, but it's something I'm just not that familiar with, it might take time for me to look up and become educated on it. But anyway, you know, feel free if you have any ideas of something you'd like me to cover. Remember, if you'd like to support the show, there are lots of ways you can do it. One is very simply to spread the word about it any way you have available to you, to people whom you think might appreciate it. You can also consider leaving a review or a rating in iTunes to let others know what you think about it and maybe encourage them to give the show a shot, give the show a try. And you can also help the show financially, either by donating directly, profcj.org/donate, or by purchasing items from Amazon by first going through the links that are found on profcj.org. And I usually try to put at least a few book suggestions based on whatever that particular episode is covering and put Amazon links, you know, with those products. Next time, I'm going to wrap up my coverage of the Bronze Age collapse by just sharing some of my thoughts on lessons that we moderns might be able to learn from this whole historical episode. Some of it's going to be things that I already sort of mentioned before in the process of covering it. Others will be things that I really haven't gotten into. But the patterns, the lessons I see, and where I think we moderns today can benefit from understanding this history. So I hope you'll tune in next time for that. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your attention. I sincerely hope I have not wasted either.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.